From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, jazz bass player Ron Carter talks about his life and music, including his recordings with the Miles Davis Quintet in the mid-60s. Carter was part of the now legendary rhythm section, along with Tony Williams and Herbie Hancock. Ron Carter has a new album called The Golden Striker. Also, we talk with inventor Dean Kamen. The FDA has just approved his new motorized wheelchair called the iBot. Kamen last made headlines with the Segway Human Transporter, the high-tech scooter that relies on gyroscopes and computer software for a balanced ride. And film critic David Edelstein reviews 13, starring Holly Hunter and Evan Rachel Wood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush said today that the U.S. is making good progress in tracking down elements of Saddam Hussein's old regime.
We're getting better human intelligence. Every day that goes by, we're getting more solid evidence from Iraqi citizens about the whereabouts of certain former thugs, or current thugs of a former regime, is a better way to put it, like Chemical Ali. And we're winning.
Meanwhile, investigators at the wreckage of the UN offices in Baghdad say there are indications that Tuesday's deadly bombing was carried out with help from someone inside the compound. The BBC's Susanna Price reports from Baghdad.
They're looking at the Iraqi employees, and in particular the guards who are working on the at the UN headquarters. Many of these had worked during Saddam Hussein's regime. There is a suggestion that some of them had had ties with the security service. And there is a quote from Bernard Kerik, who is putting the police force together here, that there are concerns about some people who are working there. Now, it's all very vague at the moment, but I think the fact that the truck bomb was driven so close to the UN, they knew exactly where to go to, they obviously knew it would be a busy time, all points to the fact that those responsible had some kind of insider knowledge.
The BBC's Susanna Price in Baghdad. Israeli troops killed a Palestinian militant today and wounded two others on the roof of a hospital in the West Bank town of Nablus. Israeli officials say they intend to kill or capture Palestinian militants following Tuesday's suicide bombing, which killed 20 people on a Jerusalem bus. In the Gaza Strip today, tens of thousands of Hamas supporters demanded revenge for the Israeli rocket attack that killed a militant leader yesterday. President Bush, sidestepping his critics on Capitol Hill, has made what's called a recess appointment of a controversial Middle East scholar to the U.S. Institute for Peace. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Daniel Pipes is to head the board of directors of the U.S. Institute of Peace, a federally funded Washington think tank. Since he got a recess appointment, he'll avoid, at least during this Congress, a confirmation process. Senator Edward Kennedy expressed disappointment, arguing Pipes' views are well known and decidedly one-sided. The Council on American-Islamic Relations accused Pipes of being an Islamophobe. In columns in the New York Post, he has advocated racial profiling to fight terrorism, saying Muslim visitors and immigrants must undergo additional background checks. Pipes, who runs the Philadelphia-based Middle East Forum, was also a founder of Campus Watch, which keeps lists of college professors who are critical of Israel. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow lost 74 points to close at 93.48. This is NPR News. The FBI is investigating two computer viruses that have been causing havoc for corporations and individual users for more than a week. The good news is that officials say that the latest virus, So Big F, is starting to fizzle. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Officials feared that So Big was going to delete files, steal passwords, or create rogue email servers for spreading junk mail. But So Big turned out not to be that big. It didn't physically damage computers, files, or critical data. Mostly, it tied up computer networking resources. Friday, the New York Times asked its employees to shut down their computers because of system difficulties. The virus arrives in an email with subject lines such as details, approved, and thank you, but only attacks when attached files are opened. So big came along just 1 week after a virus known as Lovesan and Blaster took advantage of a flaw in the Windows operating system to clog computer networks. The FBI and the Department of Homeland Security have contacted several internet service providers to try and track down the source. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Texas Governor Rick Perry has pardoned 35 people whose drug convictions were based on the testimony of an undercover agent who's been charged with perjury. All were arrested in a series of drug raids in Tulia, Texas in 1999. All the arrests were based on the word of a single undercover agent, Thomas Coleman, who didn't use any audio or video devices to document what he said were drug deals with the defendants. Civil rights groups questioned whether the arrests were racially motivated, since 39 of the 46 people arrested were black. In stocks today, the NASDAQ lost 12 points to close at 1,765. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Legacy Foundation, dedicated to building a world where young people reject tobacco and anyone can quit. www.americanlegacy.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's show, Terry's conversation with one of the most prolific and respected bass players in contemporary jazz, Ron Carter. Carter has performed on more than a couple thousand albums, with performers ranging from Eric Dolphy to Aretha Franklin. He was the leader on about 50 of those recordings. From 1963 to 68, he was part of Miles Davis's now legendary rhythm section, along with drummer Tony Williams and pianist Herbie Hancock. Carter played on several Miles Davis albums, including Seven Steps to Heaven, Sorcerer, Nefertiti, Fee to Kilimanjaro, and Miles Smiles. Ron Carter's latest recording, The Golden Striker, on Blue Note Records, is with Mulgrew Miller on piano and Russell Malone on guitar.
Now, you play bass and cello. You started with cello, right?
Yes. I was 10 years old.
How did you take it up? Was it through school?
Well, you know, in those days, and I'm going pretty far back, I guess, the teacher for the district would come by with a carload of instruments, and she would unload them into the auditorium and have everyone who was interested in music as a broad category visit, and we would have a choice of what instruments we thought could produce the sounds we were most interested in, and my interest happened to be the cello.
Did you have teachers or other adults discourage you and tell you that, well, you could do that technically, but practically it was going to be very difficult because you're African-American?
That didn't happen until I got into my later years in high school. I was 16, 17, I guess. And I looked around and I began to realize that all the little outside activities that the orchestra participated in that were of a paying sort, they went to everyone else in the orchestra in the cello section, and then somehow I never got the invitation to be a part of this situation. This is way before the really civil rights movement took place in 64, so I'm talking 51.
And this is in Detroit?
1951. Yeah, in Detroit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there was only one bass player in the orchestra at the time, and when he graduated, the logical thing to do, it seemed to be, rather than become angry, it seemed to be to put me in a position that they would have to call me. So I switched to base my senior year in high school, which would be January of 1955.
So how far did you get in the classical world, and how did you start playing jazz?
How far did I get? About 8 steps, I think.
And that's officially not far, right?
it's far enough to have them tell me that we love the way you play, but the orchestra's not ready for African-American players.
Did people actually tell you that?
Oh, yeah. I was told that several times.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I was in school, my friend and I, who was a saxophone player, started a little jazz posse at the local nightclub called the Pithot Hall, which was across from the emotional other side of the tracks. He turned out to be eventually the saxophonist who did the arrangements for James Brown, all those bigger hit records he had, Cold Sweat and I Feel Good and so on. We started a jazz posse there, and so I would play there during the evenings, during the late nights, actually, and get up in time for my 8 o'clock theory class at the Eastman School of Music. So I was already aware of the jazz community and starting to earn money for continuation of education through my little jazz gigs. The spring of 1958, Chico Hamilton rolled into town with a jazz package show that featured Miles Davis Band, Dave Brubeck Quartet, Lambert Hendrickson Ross, and the Amanda Ferguson Big Band. And Chico Hamilton's band had at the time a cello player, Nat Gershwin, Eric Dolphy, and Dennis Budimir playing guitar, and Chico, and they were looking for a cello player. So I had an audition for the band. He told me that since I had a year to go in school, I should finish school and see him in New York, which would be the following year, 1959. Well, I did finish school and graduated from Eastman and went to New York August 59. And when I arrived in New York, Chico was working at Birdland, which was then on 52nd Street and Broadway. And the bass player in the band had decided to leave the band. So he asked me would I want to join the band as a bass player. And, of course, I said yes, and we left the next week going on a three-month tour of the States.
Well, let me play a recording from early in your career. And we were talking about how you started with cello before changing to bass as your primary instrument.
Mm-hmm.
This is a 1960 recording that you made with Eric Dolphy, on which you play cello. George mm-hmm. DeVivier plays bass. It's a composition called Feather, and we're going to hear Eric Dolphy on alto saxophone, you on cello, DeVivier bass, Roy Haynes on drums. Would you say something about this recording? It's a classic.
Yeah, well, George DeVivier is one of the two or three people who I've met who have put the bass performance level on such a high professional standard. I always call George DeVivier and Milt Hinton my musical uncles because mm-hmm. they really opened the door to all that the jazz players today are privileged to have the chance to do. They played great notes. They played really well in tune. They were always on time for the jobs. They always wore suits and ties, and they had the instruments in prime shape to perform whatever music they were being called to play on. And I think those five items makes a bass player today have a great height to aspire to. A lovely man, and I'm sorry he's gone.
Feather, recorded in 1960 with Eric Dolphy on alto saxophone, my guest Ron Carter on cello, George DeVivier bass, and Roy Haynes drums. I often think that Dolphy's playing was a little sharp, and it gave him this literal cutting edge that just kind of cut through anything, and then just stuck out in a real ear-catching way. Was he sharp, and if he was, how did that affect your intonation?
Well, he always played sharp. I think guys who play the instrument that hard, physically hard, tend to play sharp because they overblow the instrument. It used to drive me crazy. I just tell Eric, Eric, man, you're playing sharp. Can you pull out? Can you do something else? You know, when you're playing in orchestras all the time, and while orchestras generally play a little above the pitch so the violins sound more brilliant, I guess, you get used to playing above the pitch, but everyone's playing above the pitch, not just one person. So it made me really tune in to where the pitch was supposed to be and made me probably more self-conscious than I should have been how much above the pitch Eric really was. There were nights when he would nail intonation. I mean, he'd be perfect, and then the bass would just do what he could do easier because it wasn't caught between my pitch and Eric's pitch. And there were other nights when he would be so sharp that it'd be difficult to make my hands do what my ear was telling me was correct, but my inner sense was saying that can't be okay.
Ron Carter speaking last year with Terry Gross. Carter's latest recording, The Golden Striker, was released this week. We'll hear more of their conversation in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with bass player Ron Carter.
I want to jump to the period of your life in the 60s when you were playing with Miles Davis. You were with him from 63 to 68?
Yes.
You were playing with Art Farmer before joining Miles Davis. How did you end up joining Miles?
Well, as it turned out, the band that he then had was going through several personnel changes. While this was going on, Miles came into the Half Note one time, one night when I had just into the second night of my two-week gig with Art Farmer, with Jim Hall, and he called me over and asked me if I was interested in joining his band. He told me that the band was breaking up. He was putting together a new group and wanted me to go to California with him the following week to work at the Black Hawk for the beginning of a six-week tour. And I said I was very interested. However, I just joined Art for these 2 weeks here, and if he would ask Art if it was okay, and if Art said yes, I'd be happy to go. If Art said no, then I'd be happy to stay with Art. So when the set was over, he called Art over, and they had a talk. They had known each other for years, and he told Art what he had in mind, and Art said it was okay, and I think that did two things for me. It established with Miles that I was really my own person, and it showed Art what kind of regard I had for him.
Were there things that Miles Davis told you about what he was doing or what he wanted you to do when you first started playing with him?
No, he would make sure, though, that I stood next to him. During those days, 63 and on, the bass player didn't have an amplifier, and they weren't no monitors on the stage, at least for the jazz bands. And everything was pretty much wide open, literally. So the instrument that had the lowest power output was the bass. That was the case in any band, so he would make sure that I stood as close to him as the stage would allow so he could understand or he could hear what was going on with the bass line. And occasionally he would say he would notice that the sound was different because I'd been off for 3 weeks, and he would say, "Your hand's a little tender tonight." Or he would say, "What is that note doing there?" And I'd explain to him what it was. He would say, "Okay." But he never once told me I should do this or I should play this kind of note or I should play on this part of the instrument. He kind of trusted my sense of judgment.
Why don't we play a recording from that early period in which you work with Miles Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we hear My Funny Valentine? And I think your bass playing on this is almost like a heartbeat.
Thank you.
That's My Funny Valentine with Miles Davis, my guest Ron Carter on bass, and that was Tony Williams on drums, recorded in 1964 live at Philharmonic Hall at Lincoln Center in New York. That's a beautiful recording. Was there something special about playing ballads with Miles Davis during that period?
Well, you know, the story is still going around that he learned a lot of space from listening to Ahmed Jamal, and that story is true. Listening to him play ballads kind of validates that view. He once said that he liked the way I played ballads with him because I understood what the melody would sound like even if he didn't play it. So I enjoyed playing ballads with him.
Oh, you mean so that you can apply the melody even if he was playing something else?
That's right.
Right, right. Miles Davis was not very communicative with his audience on stage, not verbally communicative. Was he more communicative with the musicians?
By and large, yes. Again, you know, when we go back to those early days of clubs and concerts, the setting that is now available with a separate microphone and great microphones and great microphone stands and really aware technicians and sound crews. I mean, the whole industry has changed as far as sonically reproducing a concert for an audience, be it club or concert. And then the situation was not easy for someone to announce a tune and then run back to the microphone and play. Then when it's finished, put your horn down and run back to that microphone again and announce the next song. It just wasn't physically convenient. Why he didn't talk to the audience, however, is something I can't answer.
Mm-hmm.
When we play now, I'd use segues between tunes, not because that's what he couldn't do, but I just find that if I can play a set and start a story from the first note, and have you turn the page in your mind and let my conversation not be that page turning for you.
Right.
It's like having call waiting, you know, and that really annoys me to have call waiting, to have an announcer say, now we're going to play, ladies and gentlemen. For me, that doesn't work. So I play a set for however long it lasts, straight through with these brief musical interludes to allow you to turn your own page. And I think that if he had thought of this during his time, he would have done as well.
Shortly after you joined Miles Davis, Herbie Hancock and Tony Williams joined, forming the classic Miles Davis Quintet of the mid-60s. What changed musically when you were all together?
Well, I think this was one of the cases where each of us, Herbie, Wayne, Tony, myself, would have ended up where we are now, but we ended up where we are now much quicker because we were all in the same pot then. Wynn was a very basically a quiet person, but he wrote great lines and had a great sense of harmonic direction.
It's Wayne Shorter you're talking about.
Wayne Shorter.
Who, yeah. I neglected to mention. Thank you.
Yeah, that's okay. And Herbie was starting to explore not so much new chord voicings, but places to play these new sounds. And Tony, who was at the time 17, was just opening the drums to a sets of rhythms that no one had contemplated were being possible to be done on the drums. And I think my angle, if I can use that word, would be what note ties all this stuff together.
Now, you know, Tony Williams was departing from just playing the rhythm. He was doing all kinds of
yes, absolutely.
Things. And did that make it any more or less necessary for you to be playing the rhythm?
Well, Tony was very form-oriented. Tony knew melodies inside and out, and he was studying composition and arranging. So I think one of my inputs to the band was to outline the form, because we were doing so many things within the structure. And because Herbie was playing these new chord voicings and Wayne was writing these different kind of melodies and Tony was exploring all these rhythms on different parts of the drum, in addition to what I was trying to do, I kind of nailed the form down for everybody as best I could.
So you saw yourself as being the kind of harmonic and rhythmic foundation that enabled everybody else to be more free?
Yes.
Bass player Ron Carter speaking last year with Terry Gross. Carter's latest recording, The Golden Striker, was released this week. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. Let's close this half with Nefertiti, the 1967 Miles Davis recording with Wayne Shorter on saxophone, Herbie Hancock on piano, Tony Williams on drums, and Ron Carter on bass. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Pantheon Books, a division of Random House Incorporated, publishers of Reunion, the new novel by Alan Lightman, author of Einstein's Dreams and The Diagnosis. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with jazz bassist Ron Carter. He's got a new CD. Also, we meet inventor Dean Kamen. His innovative design for an improved wheelchair has just been approved by the FDA. And film critic David Edelstein reviews 13. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with bass player Ron Carter. Carter has a new CD called The Golden Striker. When we left off, Carter was talking about his work with the Miles Davis Quintet. He played with Miles from 1963 to 68.
One other Miles Davis record I want to play here, and this is one of the first electric recordings that you made with him. And this is, we're going to hear Toot Sweet from Feed to Kilimanjaro. Did Miles Davis tell you that he wanted you to play electric bass? I mean, how did you switch then from bass to electric bass?
Well, you know, during that time, there used to be these called Blue Monday sessions. And these were clubs that had music starting at 3 a.m. in the morning, and they would go until 7 a.m. in the morning. And they were generally organ-led trios, organ, guitar, and drums. And occasionally they'd have an electric bass player who would fill in for the organist's left hand or left foot. And so I got involved in doing that even when I was going to Eastman. When I came to New York in 1959 and got involved in making a few commercial recordings, jingles, the electric bass was just now becoming a part of the recorded sound. And so every upright player had to go out and buy one to get a better view on how to play this instrument that they were now being called on to have available should the producer decide that's the sound he wanted. So the instrument was not new to me. I'd made records with it before. But I told Miles that, you know, this instrument is okay, but it doesn't have the sound that I hear that I've been working on for a very long time to get better every night at, and this just doesn't allow me that growth that I think I have to have. But it's your band, and I'll do the best I can. I think I'll do a credible job, but this is really not what I want to do.
What was it? What was missing in the sound of the electric bass?
Well, for me, just the ability to change the tone quality with my hands. I mean, bass players do it now with a pick and with their thumb and the various pedals and stuff, and they do a great job. But the color really doesn't change that much. And I think the upright player who is really conscious of the sound choices he has at his command with his hands will miss those choices playing electric bass.
Well, why don't we hear Fee to Kilimanjaro?
Mm-hmm. It's a nice track.
Yeah, this is Toot Sweet.
Yeah.
My guest Ron Carter on electric bass. This is the Miles Davis Quintet. Miles Davis Quintet with my guest Ron Carter on electric bass, recorded in 1967 from the album Fee to Kilimanjaro. We were talking about you playing electric bass on this. Herbie Hancock is playing electric piano. How did you feel playing with electric piano?
Well, you know, it was really difficult to get the sounds separated at that time. I mean, they really hadn't learned how to really record a jazz band playing these instruments because their touch is so different, and they're playing a different combination of notes and a lot more notes. They weren't being so technically conservative as they were on the early recordings of Fender Rhodes and electric bass. So it presented to them a recording problem, and I'm not sure they really solved that problem on that particular recording.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, when they were able to re-edit and remaster and remix, and with the new formats, they got a much better separation of instruments than they did on the original vinyl. But, you know, again, you know, the sounds were so almost indistinct for me, it was difficult to feel apart from everyone else, but still a part of it.
Did your dissatisfaction with the electric bass and the electric piano direction that Miles Davis was going in have anything to do with you leaving the quintet?
No, I just thought it was time to go. I'd been with the band 5 years, five fabulous years. I had a son who was 60, going on 5 years old, 6 years old. Another one was going on 2 or 3, and I thought that it's best for me to start spending more time than I was able to do with Miles' travel schedule. So I left just because of those personal reasons. Also, they were starting to get some more jazz recordings in New York. I mean, there were a lot of companies doing a lot of jazz records. The studio scene, as I defined it, was really becoming more active, and there were more African-American players being a part of these commercial recordings, and it seemed like the best time to try to find out what the industry had to offer was to be a part of it. And you can't do that if you travel 6 weeks, 6 weeks at a time for months on end.
So did your plan succeed? Were you able to stay home more and spend more time with your family?
Yes, and I'm happy to have done that.
Yeah, well, you've recorded how many CDs as a leader and a sideman over the years?
Well, you know, the last count from a friend of mine in Japan who is determined to track them all down, and he's found some really that I have completely escaped me. He's got 2,200 and change, something like that.
Yeah, very impressive. Now, I know you were on a recording by the hip-hop group, A Tribe Called Quest. Did they sample you, or did you play with them?
No, I went to the studio. In fact, the guy called me, Q-Tip called me one afternoon and told me who he was, and he was a great fan of Charlie Mingus. And I said, oh, yeah, great. You know, what can I do for you? And he said, well, we're making this record, and I want to know if you want to participate. I said, well, let me call you back because I'm busy for the moment. Actually, I was going to call my son, who's on top of that stuff. So I called him. I said, hey, man, who's this guy Q-Tip and Trap Caucus? Are they musically okay? He said, oh, yeah, Dad, you got to check them out. So I called him back, and I said, okay, we can do this. Just give me time and the place, and we work it out. They're a really lovely young man, and they're really curious about music, and I had a great time with them.
Do you still practice, or is that unnecessary because you already play so much?
You know, I just retired from City College, and that frees me up to have 20 hours a week more to practice, and I practice every day.
Good. Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, Ron Carter.
Terry, thanks very much for the invitation, and hello to your audience, and thank them for encouraging this music.
Ron Carter spoke with Terry Gross last year. His new CD as leader is called The Golden Striker. He also recorded with the Brazilian singer Rosa Passos. Here's something from their new CD, Entre Amigos.
Que eu desafino amor, saiba que isso em mim provoca imensa dor. Só privilegiados têm ouvido igual ao seu. Eu possuo apenas o que Deus me deu. Se você insiste em classificar meu comportamento diante de música, eu mesmo mentindo devo argumentar que isso é bossa nova. Isso é muito natural. O que você não sabe, nem sequer presente, é que os desafinados fotografei você na minha Rolleiflex. Revelou-se a sua enorme ingratidão.
Coming up, Dean Kamen, inventor of the Segway human transporter. His design for an innovative motorized wheelchair has just been approved by the FDA. This is Fresh Air. Dean Kamen became famous for inventing the Segway human transporter, the two-wheeled, gyroscopically balanced people mover that captured the nation's attention. But Kamen has been known for years for his medical inventions, including a portable insulin pump and a kidney dialysis machine for home use. Now he's back in the medical gadget business. The FDA has just approved the iBot, a motorized wheelchair that Kamen has spent 20 years developing. Terry spoke with Kamen in February after the Segway scooter hit the market. She asked him to describe what it looks like and how it works.
The best way to describe how it works or how it feels is like a pair of magic sneakers. It looks like a low platform about 6 inches high on which you stand, and there's a small shaft, a handle comes up, which ends up looking like the handles of a bicycle. And you have two wheels, but instead of like a bicycle where they're one in front and one in back, each one is just outside your left and right foot. So when you first look at it, you'd say, this thing must be unstable. It's missing either its front or rear axle. But in the platform that you're standing on, there are a set of 5 gyroscopes that are sensing any kind of motion, acceleration, tilt of the platform, and they feed 9 different computers, lots of information in real time, and those computers send signals out to the wheels in such a way that if the machine were even very slightly tipped forward, the wheels would run under it forward. If the machine were tilted backward, they would run backward.
When you were researching this Segway and figuring out what the computers and the gyroscopes needed to do, did you like walk a lot and try to analyze what your body was doing as you were walking?
Well, actually, it's even more than that. The Segway really comes from a medical product that I worked on for more than 10 years. I've literally spent my entire adult life working on medical products. And one that we started many, many, many years ago was a product that I thought would be a way to give the disabled population a capability that virtually no product addresses. Those people, whether they're in wheelchairs because they have no capability to move their legs, or if they're in a wheelchair or using a walker or any other device because of whether it's Parkinson's disease or MS, we find ways to move those people around. But what they've lost is the ability that we all take for granted to do something uniquely human called walking. What they lost was the specific way to move around by standing up and balancing and having a small footprint and being with their colleagues in conversation eye to eye. And so we said, you know, let's not improve the wheelchair. Let's figure out how to restore effectively human balance. And that set me on a 10-year expedition into understanding this very subtle and, frankly, from an engineering point of view, very difficult process of understanding balance and walking. We did it. We built a device called an iBot, which literally allows a disabled person to cruise down the hallway at eye level with their peers, balanced on two wheels the way their peers are balanced on their feet. It allows them to go step up and down curbs and literally walk up and down stairs. And we spent so much time trying to understand and finally succeeding in understanding how humans ambulate and balance and walk that we realized we could take the same technology and apply it to the Segway and make this technology available to the rest of the population.
What was your first invention?
As a little kid, I was always frustrated that my mother, like everybody's mother, would tell me to make my bed in the morning. And when you're not much taller than the mattress, it takes a lot of trips running completely around the bed to get the cover up on one side and then up an even amount on the other side. And then at night, you tend to muss it all up. So it occurred to me that if I attached a pulley to each corner of the blanket and tied the other two corners at the foot of the bed to the rails, then in the morning, if the pulleys at the two top corners were properly organized, I could just take a rope, pull it, and the cover would immediately spring to its normal condition of a, quote, made bed. So it dramatically reduced the trauma of having to do that.
Your mother must have thought you were crazy.
I had very, very understanding parents.
So how long did you use this bed-making system?
Oh, my guess is until the novelty wore off. But I guess what was good about that experience to me was the idea that you could see a problem, think about a solution, some abstract idea, then with a couple of tools, you could reduce that abstract idea to some physical reality that solved the problem. It sort of gave me a sense through the rest of my life that you look at the world, you find things that ought to be done differently to get a better outcome, and then you use more sophisticated tools than I had back then, like physics and engineering, and you reduce those abstract ideas to real products that help real people have a better life.
What was the first invention you sold?
The first invention I sold were, I guess today you'd call them light organs, or it was, as I was in high school, the world of semiconductors was exploding, and instead of transistors being able only to produce small amounts of power, for instance, to move the speakers in your headset, they made huge advances to where they could control thousands of watts. I think, personally, that was the birth of the disco is the result of the world of semiconductors. But you could take the output of that little amplifier that was running your speakers, run it through some of these kinds of new transistors called triacs and SCRs, and you could literally have the whole room, all the powered lights in the room, respond like music. I recognized that kids would like to do that in bands in these early days, and I started building equipment that would let them build light shows. I then started using the same equipment to run much more sophisticated light shows, and in fact built the equipment that ran the Museum of Natural History Hayden Planetarium light show pretty much when I was in high school and going into college, and then started building boxes like that to run other museum shows and industrial shows. And I would take the money that I got from building these control boxes and just buy equipment with it, more electronic equipment, oscilloscopes, etc., until I finally filled up my parents' basement with a whole electronic shop. And then at the time, my older brother was in medical school, and he would come home on the weekends, and he would start to complain about his problems. Like, he was studying, he's an MD, PhD, and he was studying pediatric, very serious pediatric problems like leukemia in babies. And he'd come home and he'd say, you know, they make all this great equipment to deliver drugs to patients in a hospital, but all these patients are, you know, adults. And suddenly he had these great ideas on how to use new kinds of drugs to treat these preemies or pediatric patients, but none of the equipment could scale down to deliver these small volumes, and it couldn't fit in isolettes. And I suddenly started thinking that I was, you know, wasting my time building what were then silly devices when I could think about how to help him or make devices that might help these babies live.
So why don't you just list some of the things, some of the medical inventions that you've come up with?
So in those early days, I started building very small pumps to deliver drugs to babies. My brother used them while he was in medical school. We got exposed to a great community of research hospitals, Harvard, Yale. And as a result of getting feedback from different fields of medicine, hematology, oncology, I started building a whole line of miniature wearable pumps, eventually ending up building a wearable pump for diabetics to deliver their insulin a number of years later. And that whole medical company we then sold. We then went on to build other kinds of medical equipment, still in some ways for delivering or measuring fluid. We started building home portable dialysis equipment so people wouldn't have to spend two or three nights a week in a hospital being dialyzed. And we built things like stents, these devices made famous by the fact that Vice President Cheney has one of ours in him. But a small device that goes into the artery that you can get there via a catheter instead of by open heart surgery. And we build the iBot, We've already spoken about that, but that was a device to help the disabled community regain essentially the same capability that people have if they can balance and walk.
Dean Kamen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dean Kamen spoke with Terry Gross in February. At that time, some pedestrian and senior citizen groups expressed worry that the Segway scooter could collide with walkers and cause injuries. The vehicles have been banned on the sidewalks of San Francisco and La Mirada, a suburb of Los Angeles. 36 states have passed legislation to allow them. Other states are leaving the decision up to individual cities and towns. Coming up, 13. This is Fresh Air. The new film 13 was co-written by 13-year-old Nikki Reed and first-time director Catherine Hardwicke. It stars Reed, now 15, and Evan Rachel Wood as two L.A. teens succumbing to peer pressure and bad influences. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
You wouldn't guess that 13 was an emotional workout just from its plot. The film is a cautionary bad girl picture, a genre that's been around since before the movies could talk. It's the stuff of laughable 50s juvenile delinquent films and after-school specials. But this one has a way of smashing through your defenses. Consider the opening. Two girls sit on a bed. They both ingested drugs. One tells the other to hit her hard. 5 or 6 blows later, both girls are bleeding and laughing hysterically, and one, the blonde Tracy, played by Evan Rachel Wood, is on the brink of passing out. It's so horrible, it's mesmerizing. It's one of the most bizarre and original ways of dramatizing desensitization and self-abuse I've ever seen. And it's like minute one. 13 jumps back in time 4 months to show us Tracy when she was still a good girl, when she listened to her mom and didn't pierce herself or do drugs or steal or have sex with boys. The instrument of change is Evie, the other girl on the bed, the girl who people can't take their eyes off in the schoolyard. Early in the film, Tracy and Evie size each other up, and the director, Catherine Hardwicke, gives us quick cuts of Evie's chains and studs and Melrose Avenue adornments. This L.A. temptress is played by Nikki Reed, who co-wrote 13 with Hardwicke. The movie is based on Reed's own life. But the producers liked Evan Rachel Wood for the good girl. They liked her willowy body and flawless skin and cool blue eyes. And she does look more conventionally defilable. 13 is the place where old melodramatic formulas and neorealist techniques and up-to-the-minute cultural details combine to make something brutally effective. Tracy's divorced mom, Melanie, is played by Holly Hunter, who turns helplessness into something so active she breaks your heart just by looking at her daughter. She and Tracy just naturally hug and touch each other. And it's when Tracy pulls back and wants a zone of privacy and starts doing things to her body that her mom can't see, that's when the trouble starts. It sounds crudely melodramatic, but it's more complicated than Good Girl Led Astray by Bad Girl. Evie's guardian, played by Deborah Kara Unger, is an alcoholic who mutilates herself with plastic surgery. Evie seems to want a real mom, maybe even Tracy's mom, to whom she reaches out while she's busy driving a wedge between them. In this scene, Evie gets a ride with Tracy and her mom to a hip L.A. boutique, and you can hear Tracy's overwhelming need to peel away from her mother in every word.
Can you take us to Melrose?
Oh, let's go. find some really cute platforms or maybe some of that body glitter.
No, no, Mom, it's okay. You can just drop us off and then go on an errand or something.
Oh. Okay. I guess that'll be all right, maybe for an hour. I have to talk to Evie's mom, though.
Brooke is just my guardian.
Great, thank you. Hey, wait a minute, wait a minute. I haven't talked to Brooke yet.
Mom, please don't do this to me. This is the best day of my life. I'll kill you if you embarrass me.
The stakes here are insanely high for something so mundane, and the director gives us quick cuts of billboards for clothes and accessories to drive home the magnetic pull of all this teenage girl's stuff. Stuff to buy or shoplift, but mostly stuff to want. The images, meanwhile, have their own truth. When Tracy and Evie and another friend walk across the school grounds in their tight jeans with their hard expressions that say, "We're so hot," they're so buoyed up by the power of their new bodies that they're practically weightless. Later, when Melanie seizes her daughter and uncovers her self-inflicted razor cuts and lets out a howl, 13 rises to the level of a primal scream. By then, the color has leached out of the image, and the camera is on top of the actors. You feel you're down with them, fighting for breath. What 13 doesn't show is how it can be important for kids to reject their parents' values and find their own. On the other hand, Tracy is 13, too young to be left to the mercy of the market. This isn't a great drama, but it's a great piece of agitprop. Not lock up your daughters exactly, but do spot checks for piercing.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Place of Hiding, a novel of mystery set on the island of Guernsey by Elizabeth George, author of the Inspector Lindley Mysteries. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Paperback Writer.
On the next Fresh Air, Word for Word, our end-of-summer review featuring some of our favorite authors. We kick off with lesbian pulp fiction writers Ann Bannon and Mary Jane Meeker. Join us for the next Fresh Air.